So one day, a few years ago, an MIT professor named Cherry Turkle saw something that would change almost everything she believed, because up until that point, Cherry Turkle was the poster child for the tech revolution, literally.
I was on the cover of Wired magazine.
The April 1996 issue. And she was a total evangelist for all the new ways we were interacting with technology.
My idea was that we would use what we learned in the virtual world to better our lives in the real world.
Anyway, that day, Sherry went to a nursing home. It was outside Boston. And she went there to see something absolutely amazing. Sherry and her graduate students would watch an elderly patient at that home interact with a robot, a sociable robot named Paro.
It looked like a baby harp seal.
You okay?
It had fur, it had big eyes with large eyelashes.
Pretty eyes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It knew language enough to respond sort of appropriately.
Yeah, how are you?
If you were sad, it made, you know, kind of comforting sad noises.
You are sweetie, you know.
I mean, it was designed to comfort the elderly. And this robot was with an older woman who'd lost a child. And there was a group of us standing around, my research assistants, the head of the nursing home, bunch of nurses, to watch the reaction of this older woman. And she was pouring out her heart about losing this child. And she was comforted by this robot. This robot made her feel understood.
It was amazing that the researchers couldn't believe how well this old woman was responding to a robot, to Paro.
I looked around and saw that this was being appreciated as progress.
Everyone who was in that room started to imagine the possibilities. Paro as friend to old people, to lonely people, to kids in hospitals. Sherry Turkle was right there, and she was watching it all happen right before her eyes.
And I felt profoundly depressed. This was a tremendous emotional turning point for me in my research.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, my robot, my friend, my replacement, the promise and the peril of how we relate to our technology. We're going to hear from TED speakers who all believe this new technology is starting to change who we are as humans, who we actually are. Some say for the better and some for the worse. So Sherry Turkle, as you've probably guessed, is really worried about where all this is headed. And when she gave her TED Talk, she described that moment watching this old woman pouring her heart out to a robotic seal.
I felt myself at the cold, hard center of a perfect storm. We expect more from technology and less from each other. And I ask myself, why have things come to this? And I believe it's because technology appeals to us most where we are most vulnerable. And we are vulnerable. We're lonely, but we're afraid of intimacy. And so from social networks to sociable robots, we're designing technologies that will give us the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. We turn to technology to help us feel connected in ways we can comfortably control. But we're not so comfortable. We are not so much in control.
Isn't there a part of you that looked at that interaction and thought it was amazing? I mean, here was this woman who had suffered a profound loss at some point in her life. She had lost a child, and she was responding to this robot. And it might not have been real, but it was real to her.
Well, no, I don't think it's amazing. And what was extraordinary to me is that although she was surrounded by people who were in a position to understand her story, we were kind of applauding and stepping back and cheering on her connection to a machine that understood nothing. And I really felt, what are we doing? Why are we essentially outsourcing the thing that defines us as people? You know, we care for our young, we care for our old, and outsourcing it to something that we knew was essentially deceiving her by tricks into thinking that it cared for her at all. you know, that was how...
So when Sherry Turkle gave her TED Talk last year, it was like a public confessional because 15 years earlier, she also gave a TED Talk, a very different one. It was a talk about how social technology would help us become better, more productive human beings. But then she changed her mind.
Over the past 15 years, I've studied technologies of mobile communication, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, young and old, about their plugged-in lives. And what I've found is that our little devices, those little devices in our pockets, are so psychologically powerful that they don't only change what we do, they change who we are. Some of the things we do now with our devices are things that only a few years ago we would have found odd or disturbing, but they've quickly come to seem familiar. People text or do email during corporate board meetings. They text and shop and go on Facebook during classes, during presentations, actually during all meetings. People talk to me about the important new skill of making eye contact while you're texting. People explain to me that it's hard, but that it can be done. Parents text and do email at breakfast and at dinner while their children complain about not having their parents' full attention, but then these same children deny each other their full attention. And we even text at funerals. I study this. We remove ourselves from our grief or from our reverie, and we go into our phones. Why does this matter? It matters to me because I think we're setting ourselves up for trouble. Trouble certainly in how we relate to each other, but also trouble in how we relate to ourselves, in our capacity for self-reflection. We're getting used to a new way of being alone together. People want to be with each other, but also elsewhere, connected to all the different places they want to be. People want to customize their lives. They want to go in and out of all the places they are because the thing that matters most to them is control over where they put their attention. So you want to go to that board meeting, but you only want to pay attention to the bits that interest you. And some people think that's a good thing. But you can end up hiding from each other even as we're all constantly connected to each other.
Okay, Sherry, can I just pause here for a sec?
Uh-huh.
What if someone is so lonely and their loneliness can be resolved by having a robot or, you know, some device to talk to? I mean, shouldn't we let them have that?
Well, I think that, you know, look, I'm not the Grinch. You know, I'm not here. I mean, let me be realistic. I don't want to be in the position of the Grinch denying the loneliest person on the planet an entity to chat with. But, you know, what are they chatting about? What is it to suggest chatting with an entity that has no idea what you're saying? So the question is, why would we want to do that to ourselves, to construct false relationships? Because when we construct robots, we are changing ourselves. We are changing what we are willing to consider a relationship.
But this is happening, Sherry. I mean, this is, you have students, you have had students over your career who are now doing this, who are working counter to everything that you are now talking about. And I'm wondering how we avoid this thing that you're worried about. How do you avoid it now?
I don't really see myself as the boy with his finger in the dike. My job is not to stop the research or say, you know, people who are doing this research are, you know, are bad people. Or I'm just saying I want to hear a more articulated conversation about what are the human values, what are the real needs that we're serving.
So, Sherry, later in the show, we're going to hear from some of your colleagues at MIT who, you know, make you seem like an outlier.
I know that when I have conversations with my colleagues or listen to TED Talks that talk about this, they always end with, if we let robots do the job, we will become more human. That's how it always ends. We will become more human. We will become more human. I'm not so sure. I think playing with our pets is something that kind of matters. And why do we want all these robot pets around? Why do we want that old woman talking to a robot? I think that at the end of life, when she wants to reflect on her life, she deserves to have people around who understand what a life is. And quite frankly, I think we need to hear the stories of her life to learn from her.
Technology is making a bid to redefine human connection, how we care for each other, how we care for ourselves, but it's also giving us the opportunity to affirm our values and our direction. I'm optimistic. We have everything we need to start. We have each other, and we have the greatest chance of success if we recognize our vulnerability, that we listen when technology says it will take something complicated and promises something simpler. But our fantasies of substitution have cost us. Now we all need to focus on the many, many ways technology can lead us back to our real lives, our own bodies, our own communities, our own politics, our own planet. They need us. Let's talk about how we can use digital technology, the technology of our dreams, to make this life the life we can love. Thank you.
Sherry Turkle, she's at MIT. 1.5 million people have watched her full TED Talk. You can too at TED.com. My robot, my friend, my replacement, we're talking about how our technology is actually changing us emotionally and even physically. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stay with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today, my robot, my friend, my enemy, the promise and the peril of how we relate to our technology. So remember that little seal, Carl? Well, we wanted to meet a robot just like that. So producer Brent Bachman and I took a little trip.
Hi, we're going to MIT?
To the MIT Media Lab, where we met some real robots. And in a room there, we saw a table with two little robots. Kind of looked like Teletubby versions of sunflowers. A small little screen right in the center of the flower. And they were kind of talking to each other. So on the other side of this lab, which is basically like a robot graveyard, except with gears and robot body parts sort of strewn about, on the other side, there was another robot. It was bigger, kind of R2-D2 sized, and that robot is called Nexi.
We're looking at basically like what looks like a bunch of metal on a chassis, and then this neck and shoulders and white head, these sort of large blue eyes, and it's kind of looking at me wistfully. So let me see what it does.
Nexi's two arms start moving.
Oh, wow.
And then...
Can I shake your hand?
Nexi, she looks right at me and says...
Hello. My name is Nexi, and I'm an MBS robot.
And as she's talking, her eyebrows move up and down.
Because I can communicate in many of the ways that people do.
Her face, it changes. It changes to reflect emotions.
I can tell you that I'm sad.
And the corners of her mouth, they go down.
Mad.
Her eyebrows narrow.
Confused. Excited. Or even bored.
And the whole time?
It's like having a conversation with me right now.
Like, she's not just looking at me. She's seeing me.
But I hope you can see that I'm very happy to have met you. Thank you for visiting me, and I hope to see you again.
How do you create that feeling? Like you're not really talking to a pile of metal and circuit boards, but you're talking to something that understands you.
Hi.
Well, you start with this woman.
Oh, now I hear a big echo.
Cynthia Brazil.
Do you hear that echo?
She directs the Personal Robots Group at the MIT Media Lab, where she basically brings robots to life, something she's wanted to do since she was a kid. When she saw Star Wars.
I wasn't that interested in seeing it initially. But once I was in the theater and you know that Imperial cruiser comes over at you, iconic scene. And then these robots came on.
They shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure.
My jaw just dropped. I couldn't believe it.
R2-D2, where are you?
I mean, they had emotions, and they were loyal sidekicks, and they helped people.
Is there anything I might do to help?
And they were amazing in their humanity, almost, right?
We seem to be made to suffer. It's our lot in life.
I was all about those robots.
And so, those robots from Star Wars?
They definitely led me, ultimately, to MIT.
And that's where, for the last 20 years, Cynthia Brazil's been building and studying social robots.
So what I've learned through building these systems...
Here's her TED Talk.
...is that robots are actually a really intriguing social technology, where it's actually their ability to push our social buttons and to interact with us like a partner that is a core part of their functionality. And with that shift in thinking, we can now start to imagine new questions, new possibilities for robots that we might not have thought about otherwise. But what do I mean when I say push our social buttons? Well, one of the things that we've learned is if we design these robots to communicate with us using the same body language, the same sort of nonverbal cues that people use, what we find is that people respond to robots a lot like they respond to people. People use these cues to determine things like how persuasive someone is, how likable, how engaging, how trustworthy. Turns out it's the same for robots.
Really? Is it the same for robots?
Well, I think the intriguing thing here is that, I mean, we are, as people, we are such a profoundly social species that when we interact with other people, the social judgments that we form, so do I like this person? Do I trust this person? Is this person credible? So much of that is established not just in what we say, but in many ways what our bodies are communicating. So it's a lot of this is around our nonverbal cues. And those nonverbal cues are processed both at a conscious level but also at a subconscious level. And what we're finding is that if you design other artifacts, you know, and people can do this with virtual avatars, and it turns out you can also do this with physical machines such as robots, if you design them in a way that adhere to those principles, then you can actually see very similar effects.
It's turning out now that robots are actually becoming a really interesting new scientific tool to understand human behavior, to answer questions like, how is it that from a brief encounter we're able to make an estimate of how trustworthy another person is? Mimicry is believed to play a role, but how? Is it mimicking of particular gestures that matter? It turns out it's really hard to learn this or understand this from watching people, because when we interact, we do all of these cues automatically. We can't carefully control them because they're subconscious for us. But with a robot, you can.
So, Nexi, the robot we met earlier?
Hello, my name is Nexi, and I'm an MBS robot.
One day she could get really good at reading and interpreting my nonverbal cues and responding to them. But how well? How good could Cynthia get at replicating us?
This is the interesting question, right? I mean, there definitely seems to be things that come into play that are just deep in how our brains work. But there are probably interesting differences, too. And I think a lot of the science and the research is really trying first to understand that, and then from an engineering level, trying to understand, well, how can you harness that to really help people?
Cynthia went over a few examples in her TED Talk. One example is that robots could be kind of like interactive Skype machines for people who live far apart.
So I imagine a time not too far from now, my mom can go to her computer, open up a browser and jack in to a little robot, and as kind of grandma bot, she can now play with my sons, with her grandson, in the real world with his real toys.
Or sticking with kids, robot technology could be used in schools to make learning more engaging and interactive.
What I've been trying to do here is create a really immersive experience for kids where they really feel like they are part of that story, part of that experience, and I really want to spark their imaginations the way that mine was sparked as a little girl watching Star Wars.
Or one of the coolest experiments with these things, one that's already been tried, a robot. Like a personal trainer. But how many personal trainers speak that way? I am your personal trainer.
So we actually explored this idea in our lab. This is a robot, Autumn.
Hi, my name is Autumn.
That's Autumn's actual voice.
I'm a personal weight loss coach.
Corey Kidd developed this robot for his doctoral work.
That's me.
And that's Corey Kidd. Corey Kidd, former student of Cynthia's.
Yeah, so I spent about 6.5 years at MIT. So that's where the Autumn project came from.
And it was designed to be a robot diet and exercise coach. It had a couple of simple nonverbal skills it could do. It could make eye contact with you. It could share information looking down at a screen. You'd use a screen interface to enter information like how many calories you ate that day.
So for each breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, how many calories. And then either
how much exercise you got.
Or how many steps they had taken that day. So we gave everyone a pedometer.
And then it could help track that for you. And the robot spoke with a synthetic voice to engage you in a coaching dialogue.
With my daily support, I help you reach your goals and keep the weight off.
So an interesting question is, does the social embodiment really matter? Does it matter that it's a robot? Is it really just the quality of advice and information that matters? So to explore that question, we did a study in the Boston area where we put one of three interventions in people's homes for a period of several weeks.
So what we did is we enrolled 45 people, people who wanted to start a diet, and 15 of those people got Autumn.
Hi, my name is Autumn.
Another 15 got a computer with the same touchscreen interface as on the front of the robot. And the third group of 15 got what is still today's standard of care, the paper log.
So one of the things we really wanted to look at was not how much weight people lost, but really how long they interacted with the robot, because the challenge is not losing weight, it's actually keeping it off.
Right. The average diet lasts only 3.5 weeks. And so for that reason, we designed the study to be 6 weeks long. And we didn't intervene during the study. So after I dropped off either the paper log, the robot, or the computer, the next contact I had with people was at about 5.5 weeks, you know, giving them a call saying the study's about over. Can we schedule a follow-up visit to pick this up and do an interview with them? And you know, one of the things I found in those interviews was that most of the people with the robot named it. Many people dressed them up, hats and scarves. One of them had a red feather boa around her neck. No, she's become like a friend. You know, can I keep her? I don't want to give her up. She's like a family member. They really developed a relationship with it.
And even when we would come up to pick up the robots at the end of the study, they would come out to the car and say goodbye to the robots. They didn't do this with the computer. Robots touch something deeply human within us. And so whether they're helping us to become creative and innovative, or whether they're helping us to feel more deeply connected despite distance, or whether they are our trusted psychic who's helping us attain our personal goals and becoming our highest and best selves, for me, robots are all about people. Thank you.
Earlier when we heard from Sherry Turkle, she told the story about watching this old woman interact with this robotic seal. And that moment was deeply unsettling. Not because she thinks robots are bad, but in a sense because she feels that in a way humans, people have failed.
You know, I think the challenge there is how you can design technologies that support our human social systems, right? So in the case of the old woman, you certainly would not want the case ever where all of her comfort could only be derived from artifacts of any kind, frankly, and not from human contact and not from family and loved ones, correct? So, you know, I think one of our design challenges is to always keep in mind our human values and how we preserve human dignity and our responsibility to each other, and recognize that technology can help. It can really help in profound ways, maybe in new ways that we still have to wrap our heads around.
Cynthia Brazil, she directs the Personal Robots Group at the MIT Media Lab. Check out her full TED Talk at TED.com. So everything we've been hearing so far is like one long wind-up to Dr. Abraham Verghese.
Yes, speaking.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, it's Verghese as in geese.
And Abraham Verghese specializes in infectious disease.
I'm a senior associate chair of the Department of Medicine at Stanford.
And he works with the absolute best medical technology in the world. And when he gave his TED Talk, he started with this story.
I tell the story of this woman who came into a hospital close by where she came in an extremist. Her blood pressure was an alarming 230 over 170. Within a few minutes, she went into cardiac collapse. They quickly resuscitated her and stabilized her, the miracles of modern medicine, and rushed her to the CAT scan suite because they were concerned about blood clots in the lung or some other catastrophic reason for her circulatory collapse. And the CAT scan revealed it was not that she had blood clots, but it showed visible bilateral palpable breast masses, breast tumors that had metastasized all over the body. And the great tragedy is that she had been seen in various healthcare settings four or five times in the preceding 2 years.
Four or five opportunities to see the breast masses, touch the breast mass, intervene at a much earlier stage than when we saw her. Ladies and gentlemen, that is not an unusual story. Unfortunately, it happens all the time. I joke, but I only half joke, that if you come to one of our hospitals missing a limb, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, or orthopedic consult. This may actually be heresy to say this at TED, but I'd like to introduce you to the most important innovation, I think, in medicine to come in the next 10 years, and that is the power of the human hand to touch, to comfort, to diagnose, and to bring about treatment.
Hey, robots, are you listening? Dr. Verghese does something you cannot.
I think, you know, in our sophistication, sometimes we forget that one timeless aspect of our profession has been of that kind of level of reassurance and comfort, which I think will never quite go away. I had an interesting debate with a well-heeled and very knowledgeable venture capital sort of person who, you know, has access to all kinds of information about illness and really was trying to make the case with me that they will not need to be a physician in a short time. It'll all be accessible to us by computers. And I was thinking, as you said, that you just haven't suffered enough. When you suffer enough, what you want, especially in addition to your best technology, best chemo, you also want a caring, empathetic physician who really expresses concern for you. And I think that aspect is why I came up with that phrase, that the most important innovation in the next decade will be recognizing the power of the human hand, not just to diagnose, but to comfort, to reassure, and to say, I will walk this path with you to the end of the line. I'll be with you. That is very important.
So when he gave his TED Talk, Abraham Verghese tells a story about another doctor and the human touch. And that doctor's name was Joseph Bell. He was a professor of medicine at the University of Edinburgh.
So picture Bell sitting in the outpatient department, students all around him, patients signing up in the emergency room and being registered and being brought in. And a woman comes in with a child, and Conan Doyle describes the following exchange. The woman says, good morning. Bell says, what sort of crossing did you have on the ferry from Burnt Island? She says, it was good. And he says, what did you do with the other child? She says, I left him with my sister at Leith. And he says, and did you take the shortcut down Inverleith Row to get here to the infirmary? She says, I did. And he says, would you still be working at the linoleum factory? And she says, I am. And Bell then goes on to explain to the students. He says, you see, when she said good morning, I picked up her Fife accent. And the nearest ferry crossing from Fife is from Burnt Island, and so she must have taken the ferry over. You notice that the coat she's carrying is too small for the child who is with her, and therefore she started out the journey with two children, but dropped one off along the way. You notice the clay on the soles of her feet. Such red clay is not found within 100 miles of Edinburgh, except in the botanical gardens, and therefore she took a shortcut down Inverleith Row to arrive here. And finally, she has a dermatitis on the fingers of her right hand, a dermatitis that is unique to the linoleum factory workers in Burnt Island. And when Bell actually strips the patient, begins to examine the patient, you can only imagine how much more he would discern. And as a teacher of medicine, as a student myself, I was so inspired by that story. But you might not realize that our ability to look into the body in this simple way, using our senses, is quite recent. The picture I'm showing you is of Leopold Ohnbruger, who in the late 1700s discovered percussion. And the story is that Leopold Ohnbruger was the son of an innkeeper, and his father used to go down into the basement to tap on the sides of casks of wine to determine how much wine was left and whether to reorder. And so when Ohnbruger became a physician, he began to do the same thing. He began to tap on the chests of his patients, on their abdomens. And basically everything we know about percussion, which you can think of as an ultrasound of its day, organ enlargement, fluid around the heart, fluid in the lungs, abdominal changes, all of this he described in this wonderful manuscript, Inventum Novum, New Invention, which would have disappeared into obscurity except for the fact that this physician, Corvisart, a famous French physician, famous only because he was physician to this gentleman, Corvisart repopularized and reintroduced the work, and it was followed a year or two later by Laennec discovering the stethoscope. Laennec, it is said, was walking in the streets of Paris and saw two children playing with a stick. One was scratching at the end of the stick. Another child listened at the other end. And Laennec thought this would be a wonderful way to listen to the chest or listen to the abdomen using what he called the cylinder. Later he renamed it the stethoscope. And that is how stethoscope and auscultation was born. So within a few years, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, all of a sudden, the barber surgeon had given way to the physician who was trying to make a diagnosis.
And then rapidly after that followed things like the EKG and angiograms and then CAT scans and MRI. But only the hand can tell where it's tender, where the patient winces. That's only the sort of thing that a human hand and a discerning observer can make out.
Back in the mid-1980s, at the height of the AIDS crisis, Abraham Verghese would make the rounds at the hospital where he worked, and it was like a death chamber. Everyone inside was dead or close to dying.
I remember every time I went to a patient's deathbed, whether in the hospital or at home, I remember my sense of failure, the feeling of I don't know what I have to say, I don't know what I can say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And out of that sense of failure, I remember I would always examine the patient. I would pull down the eyelid, I would look at the tongue, I would percuss the chest, I would listen to the heart, I would feel the abdomen, and then the next day I would come and I would do it again. And I wanted to read you this one closing passage about one patient. I recall one patient who was at that point no more than a skeleton encased in shrinking skin, unable to speak. When he saw me on what turned out to be his last hours on this earth, his hands moved as if in slow motion, and as I wondered what he was up to, his stick fingers made their way up to his pajama shirt, fumbling with his buttons. I realized that he was wanting to expose his wicker basket chest to me. It was an offering, an invitation. I did not decline. I percussed. I palpated. I listened to the chest. I think he surely must have known by then that it was vital for me just as it was necessary for him. Neither of us could skip this ritual, which had nothing to do with detecting rales in the lung or finding the gallop rhythm of heart failure. No, this ritual was about the one message that physicians have needed to convey to their patients. Although God knows of late in our hubris, we seem to have drifted away. We seem to have forgotten. As if with the explosion of knowledge, the whole human genome mapped out at our feet, we are lulled into inattention, forgetting that the ritual is cathartic to the physician, necessary for the patient. Forgetting that the ritual has meaning and a singular message to convey to the patient. And the message, which I didn't fully understand then, even as I delivered it, and which I understand better now, is this: I will always, always, always be there. I will see you through this. I will never abandon you. I will be with you through the end. Thank you very much.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, His full TED Talk is called The Human Touch, and you can find it at ted.npr.org. So with all that amazing, incredible, wondrous technology being developed, technology that will really change the way we relate to each other, we're still limited. There are things technology will never be able to replicate, like the human soul and the human touch. And there's something reassuring about that. Don't you think? We talk like machines with moving parts and electric dreams. Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. And you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, Brent Bachman, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Well, a very clear hit has been the game Angry Birds. The company behind it, Rovio, says it is the number one paid app of all time. It's been downloaded 1.7 billion times. And starting tomorrow, the company that created Angry Birds is releasing a cartoon series directly through its games. That series will also be shown on international TV channels, though in the U.S., the main way to see it will be inside the mobile game. As NPR's Mandalay Del Barco reports, Rovio is sidestepping traditional distribution deals with major Hollywood players.
Angry Birds is just so simple, says Rovio's Andrew Stalbo.
They're very unique birds, with each with very special powers, that each of which get very upset and aggravated by the very rascalish pigs who have stolen their eggs.
In the game, players use slingshots to catapult the colorful birds, who don't fly, to destroy structures hiding the green pigs. The new Angry Birds cartoons go one step farther.
There's a whole infrastructure to the pigs' world. They live on an island that has some amazing stories to tell.
Stalbo, who's in charge of Rovio's strategic partnerships, is only a little ambitious about how far his birds and pigs can fly.
I would describe them as most closely aligned to, say, Tom and Jerry. And I think we're thinking about really Looney Tunes for the mobile generation.
New 3-minute episodes will be revealed every week when players push a button on the 99-cent game app.
At its heart, you know, it's just fun to play. It's basically just slingshotting birds, so anyone can understand it.
Kirk Hamilton is features editor for Gawker Media's gaming website. He says the startup Rovio has already thrown the video gaming industry for a loop and could do the same for TV.
I think that's the thing that makes this really interesting, is that they have this huge embedded audience who all have a way to just give them money already. So they're just giving them more stuff to spend money on.
4 years after the small Finnish company launched its digital game, Rovio has become a major player in the entertainment world. Rovio joined forces with Lucasfilm to come up with a Star Wars Angry Birds cartoon, games, and merchandise. They've partnered with 20th Century Fox, National Geographic, and even NASA. There are now Angry Birds plush toys, lunchboxes, T-shirts, books, and Angry Birds theme parks in Europe and China. The company makes most of its money from merchandise and advertisers on its games and YouTube channel with more than 1 billion views. With its new cartoon series, Rovio is betting on new media to directly collect more revenue from its fans and advertising partners like Paramount Pictures and Sony Pictures and BlackBerry. Executive Vice President Stalbo says that puts Rovio in a unique position.
The world's changing, where a really small company of 12 people in Helsinki can compete with a big media company who has significantly more resources because the platforms are more accessible to everybody. So it's an exciting time for any startup out there because the playing field just got leveled.
In 3 years, Angry Birds is set to be a feature-length film. Where will it end? How long will the birds be angry? And when will those pigs stop stealing their eggs? Stalbo says there are generations of bad blood between them, so many more stories to tell on many different devices.
Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
NPR's business news starts with a new smartphone. Samsung unveiled its latest top-of-the-line offering last night, the Galaxy S4. The company worked overtime to transform its product launch into a cultural event. Samsung rented out Radio City Music Hall in New York, invited 6,000 guests, and as NPR's Steve Henn reports, close to 500,000 people watched live online.
If this were a show, the reviews would have been brutal. It was less a press conference than a tongue-in-cheek Broadway review. Samsung called the event unpacked, but it was kind of unhinged. It came complete with bad jokes, brassy music, and child actors.
Dad, tell me that's not true.
Hey, I'm sorry, honey. I'll get the Galaxy S4 after the presentation.
Samsung spent more than $400 million on advertising last year, and the Galaxy S3, its last top-of-the-line phone, briefly outsold Apple's iPhone. But it's impossible to imagine Apple doing anything like this.
It does the product a disservice.
With Charles Galvin, he's a tech analyst at Forrester Research.
All of this stuff is really it's a distraction, right, from the great piece of hardware and really interesting software that they've developed.
Samsung's new phone actually does some pretty amazing stuff. It translates a handful of languages on the fly. You can control it with gestures, wave at it to answer the phone, and if you're watching a video and you look away, the video will pause. The phone has sensors that measure humidity and air pressure. It even works as a TV remote. Prices haven't been announced, but Galvin says he's confident Samsung has a hit, just not one for Broadway. Steve Henn, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Director of National Intelligence says the prospect of a cyber attack is now the number one security threat. In remarks this week, James Clapper ranked the cyber threat above terrorism. Plenty of leaders have issued warnings, like former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's statement about a cyber Pearl Harbor. NPR's Tom Gelton has covered this threat for years, yet some of the rhetoric got him wondering if the threat is overstated.
The country's top intelligence officer and the top cyber officer were both on Capitol Hill this week, warning that the danger of computer attacks needs to be taken a lot more seriously. National Intelligence Director James Clapper said it's hard to overestimate its significance. General Keith Alexander, head of the U.S. military's Cyber Command, explained the threat to Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
All our systems today, our power systems, our water systems, our governments, our industry depend on computers, depend on computerized switches, and depend on these networks, all that are at risk. If an adversary were to get in, they could essentially destroy those components.
Could do as much or more damage than the attacks of 9/11.
That's correct. I think it would.
A cyber Pearl Harbor? A cyber attack as bad as 9/11? But Clapper and Alexander's testimonies were worded carefully. Clapper, speaking for the U.S. intelligence community, said there's only, quote, a remote chance, unquote, of a major computer attack during the next 2 years. Russia and China, the powers capable of mounting such an attack, have no reason to, Clapper suggested. General Alexander of Cyber Command said foreign leaders know a big cyber attack on the United States might be traced back to them and therefore would not want to run the risk of a U.S. counterattack. So, is the scare talk just hype? James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says he put that question to what he calls one of the leading hypers of the cyber threat.
I said, oh, come on, you know it's not going to be Pearl Harbor. And he said, yeah, but he wants people to pay attention that nobody's doing anything. So there's some folks out there who believed we needed to hype the threat to get the country to move on the theory that democracies don't do anything until they've had a disaster. He's probably right, but I think it has been overhyped.
Cybersecurity experts in both industry and government say the country is unprepared to deal with computer threats. But the immediate problem is cybercrime and cyber espionage, not cyber war. President Obama's national security advisor, Tom Donilon, this week accused computer hackers from China of stealing confidential business information and technology.
Increasingly, U.S. businesses are speaking out about their serious concerns about sophisticated, targeted theft through cyber intrusions emanating from China at a very large scale.
Industry and government leaders say the everyday theft of trade secrets is undermining the U.S. economy. Beyond that, there is the danger in the future that some country might be tempted to launch a major cyber attack that could knock out the power grid or paralyze the financial system. That would be seen as an act of war, according to U.S. officials. It's unlikely now, but some up-and-coming cyber powers are a cause for concern. Cyber expert James Lewis notes that Iran, previously considered a minor cyber player, apparently went after the state oil company in Saudi Arabia recently.
One thing most of us didn't expect was the Iranians to go from zero to 60 in about 8 months. China, Russia, these are responsible countries. They're not going to start a war. How comfortable do you feel saying that about the Iranian Revolutionary Guard?
At this point, even the leaders of Iran may see little reason to spark a major cyber confrontation with the United States. That calculation, however, could at some point change, considering the current hostility between the two countries. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.